Thanks, Jamie. So if any of you need motivation to lead a service sometime, it's really cool to sit up here and watch Jamie's feet move. So you can, that's your special bonus for leading a service. Tena koto te whanau o Auckland Unitarians. Tena koto na manuhere, hiri. No mai, haere mai. Haere mai ki to tato whanau. Haere mai ki te hui o te ra nei. Tena koto, tena koto, tena ra tato katoa. No ingarangi kotirani tiamana me huitarangi o kutipuna. I whanau mai o i Hartford, Connecticut. I tupu ake o i Baltimore, Maryland. I tai mai o ki Aotearoa i te tōrua manu mā waru. Ko Martha's Vineyard tōku karanga motu. Ko Tiasquam tōku karanga awa. Ko Vineyard Haven Moana tōku karanga moana. Ke Hauraki o Tamaki Makaurau aho, aho e noho ana. Ko Kate aho. My ancestors hail from England, Scotland, Germany, and Switzerland. I was born in Hartford, Connecticut, and raised in Baltimore, Maryland. I arrived in New Zealand in the year 2008. Martha's Vineyard is the island that calls to me. The Tiasquam is the river that calls to me. Martha's Vineyard is the harbor that calls to me. I'm currently living in Hauraki on the North Shore of Auckland. I'm Kate. We welcome you into this space made sacred by Auckland Unitarians for over 120 years. If you're in the church, and sorry, I should say, we welcome you if you're online as well, and also if you're watching this recording afterwards. If you're in the church, please join us for morning tea. It is our sacrament of hospitality. The opening words are by Andrew Pakula. Come into this circle of community. Come into this sacred space. Be not tentative. Bring your whole self. Bring the joy that makes your heart sing. Bring your kindness and your compassion. Bring also your sorrow and your pain. Bring your brokenness and your disappointments. Spirit of love and mystery, help us to recognize the spark of the divine that resides within each of us. May we know the joy of wholeness. May we know the joy of being together. Now is the time to light the chalice. This is a poem called Thirsty by Gregory Pelly. And so we gather from the ebb and flow of our lives, thirsty for connection to ourselves, thirsty for connection to others, thirsty for connection to the larger life. As we light this chalice, may all who gather here be filled, filled with joy and hope, filled with compassion and love. Here may we be filled so that we may pour ourselves out into the world. Please join me in saying the covenant of the church. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest for truth is the sacrament. And service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace,
to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve human mind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony, thus to be covenant with each other and with our God.
I meant to put that optional with our God and I forgot. That was fun last week. Jamie is going to play a musical interlude now, Intermezzo by César Franck.
Thank you.
So the other reason to lead a service is that you get to stand up here in between the pipes when he's playing, which is awesome. So lots of plugs to lead the service. My talk is called The Healing Power of Self-Compassion. I'm very aware that this is the first service since Clay died that we're not using one of his talks. And I've been on the calendar to do this for several months, and Ted and I decided that it would be an all right topic for today since we're hurting, and I hope that some of these words may be useful for all of us in dealing with grief. I also feel the need to give a disclaimer because I'm an academic and this isn't my field. I'm talking about self-compassion because becoming more compassionate towards myself and others is a path that I'm on and something I'm striving for. I've become interested in the psychology behind it and have done some reading, and I'm convinced that most of us can benefit from an increased dose of self-kindness. Our second principle explicitly points to the importance of compassion in human relations. I think that we can make the world a better and kinder place if we work on ourselves first and then spread that love and compassion to others. I think that so many of us suffer from a lack of self-compassion that there is something to be learned in talking about our experiences. Since I'm not a psychologist or scholar in self-compassion research, this is based on my personal experience and reading and thinking about it. It's a work in progress. I can imagine Clay laughing at me, saying, "Of course, Kate, this is about what makes us human and about the attempt to be more loving." So I hope he would say that that's enough. The last song that we're singing today is called The Greatest Love of All, made famous by George Benson in 1976 and Whitney Houston in 1985. I'm having us sing it because it mostly fits the theme, except that there is one thing that I really take issue with. In the chorus, they sing, "The greatest love of all is easy to achieve. Learning to love yourself is the greatest love of all." I have found that learning to love myself, to feel and act out of compassion for myself, is the hardest thing to achieve. It is not straightforward and it is not easy. For most of us, loving and caring for ourselves is way harder than loving and caring for other people. It takes a lot of patience, work, and drumming up kindness for ourselves when we're hurting, especially when we blame ourselves for that hurt. We have to begin by seeing ourselves and how we are in the world in a different way, and that insight may be the hardest thing. I was up at the altar a few months ago sharing my joy at finally seeing a specialist who I hope can help me with chronic sleep problems. The specialist and I agreed that the sleep issues were fundamentally associated with my high levels of anxiety, and he recommended a threefold treatment, including medication and psychological support. The third thing was completely new to me, coming from a psychiatrist, and that was to acknowledge my high level of self-criticism and to tone that down by increasing my level of self-compassion. I was suspicious. I've heard people pushing self-compassion, and my response was a big negative, no way. As with many other people, a variety of fears and resistance went through my head. From self-compassion researcher Kristen Neff on People's Resistance, "Isn't self-compassion just a form of self-pity, or a dressed-up word for self-indulgence? Won't being nice to myself make me weak, selfish, or lazy?" From Stan Steindl, another researcher in self-compassion, "Do we worry that being compassionate towards others will make us weak and people will take advantage of us? Do we feel we don't deserve to receive compassion from someone else?" Yes, all of the above. But here's the twist. A decade of research and thousands of projects have shown that the opposite is true. If we care for ourselves better, want health and well-being for ourselves, we become more proactive to better our situation. We don't become passive, lazy, and self-indulgent. We become better friends and lovers, better parents, better citizens of the world. Our third principle points to the importance of accepting one another. Self-compassion research suggests we can do that by being more accepting of ourselves. As Neff writes, self-compassion doesn't make you weak. In fact, it's an incredibly powerful source of strength, coping, and resilience. It's not selfish. It leads to more giving and caring relationship behavior and allows us to sustain giving to others without becoming drained. And far from making us lazy, self-compassion is like rocket fuel for getting things done, keeping us focused on our goals, reducing performance anxiety, and most importantly, allowing us to learn from our mistakes so we can grow from them. The ever-expanding body of research on self-compassion shows it can radically transform our lives for the better. Buddhists have practiced it for centuries. Neff and fellow researchers found that in countries where Buddhism plays a larger role in daily life, such as Thailand, people are much more self-compassionate. So why are we so resistant to self-kindness, self-love, and self-compassion? As Steindl says, we have tricky brains. We have brains that are both ancient or reptilian, hundreds of millions of years in development, and newly developed over the last few tens of thousands of years since we became human. Our ancient brains are threat and drives oriented. We prefer to err on the side of mistakenly identifying a threat that isn't there than to miss a threat that is. But we can't always avoid threats. Sometimes we have to leave the cave to go out and get food. We want to improve our situation. We want to make things better for ourselves and for our group. We also have a desperate need to stay in our human group. We will do pretty much anything to avoid being expelled from our group, because for our ancestors, that was the only way to survive. We're born into circumstances that we didn't choose and over which we have no control. These circumstances and the behavior of adults around us in childhood and adolescence affects our brains and our behavior and thought processes, and we have no control over that. As Steindl puts it, it is not your fault. Out of this messiness of our brains and our development, it is very easy to develop an inner critic. This is a voice that criticizes our behavior and our thoughts and our feelings. It often comes from how our parents were with us, but it can come from any adults who were critical and judgmental with us. In some cases, we don't know where it came from, just that we have a critical inner voice that may be hateful and harsh. If we feel humiliation and shame as children, we incorporate that into our brains and carry it with us into adulthood. This can turn into self-criticism. The strength of the inner critic depends on the person. Some are mild and some are ferocious. When I started talking to my sleep specialist psychiatrist, he said, your self-critic has a PhD. We laughed about it, but he's absolutely right. My self-critic is highly trained and eloquent and has fine-tuned the art of casting doubt. It has made it almost impossible for me to be good enough. I am a master procrastinator because I dread putting words down that may show my lack of eloquence and foolishness. I spent a long time deciding on whether to do this talk because of my lack of expertise. There is an irony to the suffering I caused myself while preparing a talk on self-compassion. This talk fired up my highly educated self-critic. How dare you talk about self-criticism and self-compassion when you're not an expert? What do you know? Everyone will judge and criticize your hubris. They won't like you anymore. They'll kick you out of the group. You don't need to have a PhD to have a relentless self-critic, however. You just need to be human and have lived through some challenges while your brain was developing. It is way too normal and common. And there is a way out through self-compassion. Kristin Neff talks about three core components of self-compassion: self-kindness, recognition of our common humanity, and mindfulness. Self-kindness means being gentle and understanding with ourselves rather than harshly critical and judgmental. Recognition of our common humanity means feeling connected with others in the experience of life rather than feeling isolated and alienated in our suffering. Mindfulness is holding our experience in balanced awareness rather than ignoring our pain or exaggerating it. Our first principle says we should recognize the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and that includes yourself. I have been working through Steindl and Neff's books and doing a lot of exercises, reflecting on how I've come to be the way I am and how to change it. Both researchers emphasize doing things, writing, reflecting, meditating, both with and without imagery. We can retrain our brains to be more loving towards ourselves and others. It is a huge part of the process to learn to feel compassion, to feel loving feelings towards yourself. This can be very painful and difficult at first, and I rebelled over and over. Steindl helped by starting with imagining an ideal compassionate being. What would that look like? What would that feel like to be embraced by total love, total understanding, total forgiveness? This caused a lot of tears for me, letting myself feel completely and unconditionally loved. Then Steindl has us imagine our compassionate self, take those feelings that our ideal being and that our ideal being has given us, and realize we can do that for ourselves. What? Really? How can this be okay? It is okay. It's more than okay. It is life-changing and helps both us and those around us. I said earlier that Steindl writes that many aspects of our lives are not our fault. Much of our suffering is not our fault. But critically, he adds that it is our responsibility. We have to decide how we want to be in the world. We have to retrain ourselves to be the way we want, and self-compassion can help us. So the obvious question is this helping me? Am I taking better care of myself, being less self-critical, sleeping better? Sort of. I'm still too overcommitted and stressed and don't take enough time to exercise or recover from long work weeks. I still procrastinate out of fear of being judged and criticized by others. Changing decades of bad sleep habits takes a very long time. The difference now is that I have hope that I am taking steps towards helping myself and therefore those that I love. I'm being a better friend and a better citizen in the world because I'm holding myself as precious, and therefore everyone else as precious as well. It's a work in progress. Please say with me the words for extinguishing the chalice.
We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, or the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. It needs to be carried in our hearts until we are together.
Our final song, as I said earlier, is The Greatest Love of All. So I did a little reading about it. It was written by Linda Creed and Michael Masser in 1976. And I learned this week that the song was written for the film The Greatest about Muhammad Ali. So it has a more interesting history than I knew about. We are singing a version closer to the George Benson version, so we don't have to feel like we need to sound like Whitney Houston. Blessing for Risk Takers and Failures by Robin Tanner. Today we share in a blessing for losers, risk takers, all failures far and wide. Blessed are they who fall in the mud, who jump with gusto and rip the pants, who skin the elbows and bruise the ego, for they shall know the sweetness of risk. Blessed are they who make giant mistakes, whose intentions are good but impact has injured, who know the hot sense of regret and ask for mercy, for their hearts will know the gift of forgiveness. Blessed are they who have seen a D or an F or C or any letter less than perfect, who are painfully familiar with the red pen and the labels as less than, for they know the wisdom of the imperfect. Blessed are they who try again, who dust off, who wash up, who extend the wish for peace, who return to sites of failure, who are dogged in their pursuit, for they will discover the secret to dreams. Blessed are they who refuse to listen to the naysayers, for their hearts will be houses for hope. Blessed are they who see beyond the surface of another, for they will be able to delight in the gift of compassion. Blessed are they who stop running the race to help a fellow traveler, who pick up the fallen, who stop the injured, who stop for injured life, for they shall know the kindness of strangers. Blessed are they who wildly, boldly abandon winning, for they shall know the path of justice. I think we do have time for a short discussion today. So after this, we'll break up into small groups. 5 people, no more than 5. Here's the question. If you are feeling brave, please share how you and people close to you are affected by self-criticism. I added the if you are feeling brave because that can be a very hard question for some people. How can you practice self-compassion and encourage it in others? Okay, so now Frank is going to play the postlude. The postlude is Chaconne in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach. It was written for violin, but has been arranged for piano by Ferruccio Busoni. It is thought that Bach wrote it while in mourning for his first wife, who died in 1720. Johannes Brahms wrote that the Chaconne contained a whole world of deepest thoughts and most powerful feelings. John Spicer, a physician who recommends listening to Bach to help doctors learn to listen compassionately to patients, wrote, "To most ears, the music reveals love, anguish, death, and fear. It is rich in emotion." It is 6 minutes long, so sit back and relax.